Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and got a good episode here coming up for you tonight. Lots of information flowing in about COVID from around the country, and we've got our own frontline reports coming in as well from members of the team and members of the community. And we're going to get into that here in just a second, but we have to first check in with our able and amazing co-host, Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Oh, gosh, Jamie, you're making me blush again. Well, I tell you, we're at the end of 2020, and I can't be happier. Not that I don't know that 2021 is going to be some magic panacea of wonderful things, but we can only hope. And on that note, poor Dr. Joe is losing his hair over COVID because you told me, as we were chatting earlier, that Tennessee is one of the main, and your particular area is getting, you know, is basically on overflow status. So why don't you talk a bit about what's going on with that?
Well, I say I'll be glad to, although it's not much to be proud of. So what I was referring to earlier was I saw a couple of different news stories today that noted that Tennessee is the fastest growing COVID rate in the country right now. Just in my county alone, we had over 1,100 new cases reported yesterday. Just a month ago, we were trucking along at about 100 new cases a day, so we're up tenfold. And we, all across the state, but particularly in my part of the state, are really, feeling the heat to some extent. Hospitals are very full, at capacity, if not beyond in some cases, holding in emergency departments all across the region for me now is, more than 50% of emergency department beds are occupied with admitted patients with nowhere to go. And that, of course, has resulted in extensive delays in offload for EMS of many hours in many cases. You know, we're still not we're not at the peak of this thing yet. It's going to get quite a bit worse before it gets better. We're in an exponential increase right now in daily new cases. Part of the frustration with that is that about half the people that are COVID positive are completely asymptomatic and therefore are spreading the virus unknowingly. This is an extremely contagious virus, much like measles. So it is very easy to pass, as you've and our audience has heard for the last 9 months at least. And currently, as we look at our epidemiological data and dig into the numbers a bit, it seems very apparent that while we may be seeing 1,000 cases a day, the truer number is that there are probably 5,000 to 6,000 new cases a day, and that those are simply people that are asymptomatic or very minimally symptomatic, and or who do not go and get tested. So the actual pool of active virus is several times larger than the reported positivity, and I think that's true pretty much everywhere in the country. I think in many ways the efforts by governmental entities at the city, county, regional, and state level are struggling to make a difference anymore. You know, the growth rate has boomed pretty substantially, and it's much more difficult now to actually see the impact of social distancing, masking, and all the things that we're trying to get folks to do, because the numbers are increasing very quickly, exponentially. And, you know, where 2 months ago there were 10,000 positive cases, now there are 100,000 positive cases. And so even if the growth rate wasn't as fast, there are so many more people out there with the infection that the growth is now really overwhelming us in many cases. So things are looking a little bleak for us.
So you being the medical director of all things Memphis and Tennessee, what's the contingency plan? What happens when you're really overflowing?
Yeah, I move out of state.
I wasn't expecting that.
I get a vaccine and then I move out of state. There are quite a few. You know, I mean, all the hospitals are working hard to maximize their surge capacity. We have had extensive discussions around activating volunteers, the Medical Reserve Corps. How do we incent folks with nursing, medical, and EMS licensure to who might be retired or semi-retired to sort of re-enter the workforce a bit and assist? We're aggressively discussing the opening of our alternate care site. Part of the interesting challenge there is that many of these alternate care locations were funded through federal dollars, state dollars, et cetera, that were focused specifically on COVID relief. And therefore, the alternate care hospital is set up to only take care of COVID patients. And we're actually trying to decide, does that really make sense for us? We think that it might make more sense to move non-COVID patients to that location and try to offload our hospitals a little bit, maintaining the higher capability of a fully functional hospital for COVID patients, and putting those who are a bit easier to care for, and in many cases are simply waiting, for example, placement in a skilled nursing facility or something like that. But, you know, we're waiting 2 or 3 days for that placement to occur. If we can get them out of that bed, we can use that for a COVID-related patient. So quite a few things along those lines. Vaccination, I think, is going to help us, but it's going to take a while. We started vaccinations in this area yesterday, and we can certainly spend a lot of time talking about vaccinations if you'd like.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to get around to that. Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, Joe. I mean, you know, I know that a lot of places have these overflow surge facilities, whether it's, you know, building a field hospital in the convention center or, you know, whatever else they may have as a contingency. But the challenge still comes down to finding staffing for all of these things. And one of the advantages we had in the first surge back in April, March, April, May, that area, was that it was all pretty much confined to the Northeast. And so we were able to move staff from other areas to cover. Now that the whole country is kind of a hot spot, is there a source of staff? I know you mentioned retired persons and things like that. You're trying to reactivate people, but is there another source of staff out there, or are you having to make decisions that are uncomfortable as far as staffing goes?
I think the short answer to that is no. We see aggressive bidding for staff, and a lot of folks deciding to go do travel nursing or whatever because the dollars are awfully hard to pass up in places that are really desperate and have funding. Competition for caregivers is really difficult right now. And I think in many places around the country, we are in a situation where we are kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul. because there are not enough people to go around, and there's sort of nowhere else to draw from. You know, if we can pull in some folks on the margins a little bit, retired, semi-retired, part-time, redirecting clinic staff, for example, or outpatient surgical staff toward inpatient care, you know, it's reapplying the folks that are in the workforce. But ultimately, I don't think there is anywhere a really deep pool of folks who are not actively working as much as they can already. So it is truly a huge challenge. And at a really bad time of year in the U.S., we're just entering flu season. We're just beginning to see flu numbers going up, which, of course, is simply going to complicate things. You know, we always get a rise in hospital admissions over the course of the flu season due to issues related to flu. And so those are going to be on top of our already overburdened hospitals who are managing many, many, many cases of COVID-19.
Jamie, go ahead.
Yeah. What about have you seen any situations where, you know, you have evidence that people are avoiding going to the hospital? I know that was a problem in early on in some places where people were who were symptomatic for some pretty serious things, whether it's chest pain or stroke symptoms and avoiding going to the hospitals. Are we in a position where that kind of care is no longer available?
That's a great question, Jamie. And I don't know that in real time, we have a very good way to assess that. You know, a lot of the information and what we saw with those behaviors was in retrospect. When, you know, cardiac arrest rates climbed pretty dramatically and, you know, acute MIs dropped off a lot and the you know, cardiac arrest death rate went up. You know, you sort of tie those two things together and say, well, those folks were symptomatic, but they didn't come to the hospital. That may well be happening now, partially out of fear of contracting COVID, partially out of the fact that I may have to sit in an ER for hours before I can get seen because there's no place to go that is not not currently overburdened. So I don't doubt that that is occurring some, but I don't have any way to have a sense of sort of how much of that's going on. It's certainly a concern.
Well, Joe, what about telemedicine? I noticed, you know, I'm a Kaiser patient, so they're always telling you that's available. So it seems to be out there. So people that are symptomatic don't want to go to the ER. At least they can consult with a physician who may say, you really need to go to the ER.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're certainly seeing much more aggressive use of tools like that. We're actually using it in our EMS system where we actually have a medical provider in a vehicle that can respond with a medic and do medical screening and redirect patients in the field, as well as be contacted via telemedicine from some of our other EMS units in the field for patients who have very low acuity complaints and may be amenable to other sites of care. I think those programs are extremely valuable, but at the same time, I think no matter how successful we are with those programs, we are still seeing a lot of really sick people at the hospital, and there's just no place else for them to go. Except to the hospital because they're all that sick.
Yeah. Well, I know a question Becky would ask is, how is the mental health of all the hospital providers and all of the first responders given the extra stress they're under and have been for some time?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, we've talked about that several times here. I think there's no question that the stress levels are astronomical right now. You know, EMS providers are literally spending hours, you know, in an ED with a sick patient trying to find some way to offload them so they can get back to work. And, you know, there's no place to go. As well as ever increasing numbers of COVID positivity or exposed members of EMS, nursing, hospital staff, et cetera. You know, we're as the number of asymptomatic folks continues to increase in the general population, we see equal numbers of those increases in the healthcare provider population, the EMS population as well. So more and more people off with illness or exposures. Just in the services that I work with on a regular basis, we've had a number of deaths of EMS workers' spouses or family members directly related to COVID, and I'm talking young, healthy people. Even COVID positivity in my own extended family at this point. So it's just everywhere now and becoming harder and harder to avoid because of the pervasiveness of this virus at the moment.
Well, at least given that the vaccine is out and the first responders are starting to get it, that should take a little of the stress off. But since I mentioned the V word, what do you know about the vaccines? I guess the second company now has gotten approval. Is that true?
That's correct. Moderna has been approved as well. It appears to be as equally good as the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna vaccine does not require the ultra cold storage temperatures that the Pfizer vaccine requires. So a bit of an easier logistical challenge. It appears right now that the majority of the Pfizer vaccine is being directed toward hospitals and that sort of stuff. And I think part of the reason for that is the cold storage capabilities tend to be there as opposed to rural health departments and that kind of stuff. And so I think particularly for EMS and the folks that I spend a lot of time working with, we will most likely be receiving the Moderna vaccine next week. And I am looking forward to getting my vaccination done as quickly as I can get access to it. It certainly appears that these vaccines are extremely safe, extremely effective. As a matter of fact, they appear to be more effective than the disease itself in preventing future disease. So the current recommendation is that everyone get vaccinated unless you have a specific allergy, anaphylactoid type allergy to injectable vaccines. There's the plus to these things is that there's no preservatives in them. They do not contain a whole lot of other chemical byproducts apart from the mRNA and some nanolipids and that sort of stuff. So there's not much in there to respond to. So thankfully, it's a fairly small number, I think, of folks who will have true allergic related issues. That folks, even folks that have had the disease already, are recommended to get vaccinated. Although we can talk about some caveats around that if there's questions about it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, go ahead and mention those, Joe, if you like.
Sure.
Those caveats.
Sure. Well, so the current thinking is that if you have had COVID-19, you have developed some antibodies to the virus, and therefore, after you are through the acute phase, i.e. the first couple of weeks, and are no longer symptomatic, that you have developed your own immunity. And what we know so far is that that immunity appears pretty good for at least 120 days. Now, it may well be 5 years, but you know, we've only had 9 months with the virus, so we can't say that yet because it hadn't been 5 years yet. So we don't know the answer to that, but folks who have had COVID and are asymptomatic can get vaccinated and should get vaccinated as soon as they can get access to it. But it's also okay for those folks to wait 90 to 120 days before they get vaccinated because they already have some antibodies and they are already safe. They're protected from the virus and they're also not infectious. So they could wait until later on when the vaccine is more available, particularly if they're EMS service, for example, you know, only got 100 doses and there's 120 people. Well, you know, you could wait 3 months safely and not put yourself or your colleagues at risk.
Well, I hope that word gets out. What about side effects, Joe? I've heard some grumblings about that, but
yeah, they seem to be extremely rare. There have been in the U.S., two reported cases of sort of an anaphylactoid, not anaphylaxis, but an anaphylactoid type reaction, one of which was a bit more severe than the other, but both those patients recovered within 24 hours and were doing fine. Similar to a couple of episodes that occurred in the U.K., who was a few weeks ahead of us in their vaccination schedules. And that those tended to occur in patients who already had a prior history of pretty severe allergic reactions. For example, the folks in the UK were both patients that carried EpiPens all the time because of their severe allergy situation. So, you know, that's a relatively small number of folks. And obviously, quite a bit of studies going on now to figure out what triggered that response in the first place. And I feel like it won't take long to identify that. There's just not a lot in this vaccine, and therefore it shouldn't take too long to kind of figure out what's going on that might have resulted in this anaphylactoid type reaction. So that's currently really the only contraindication, is if you have a history of significant allergic reactions to injectable vaccine, you should not get it right now and continue to protect yourselves with distancing and masking, et cetera.
Well, that's good to know. That's concrete information. Jamie, you had a question?
Well, I just wanted to kind of mention that, you know, I've heard that there are some, you know, the minor flu-like or immune system reactions that are happening when people get the injections that just kind of says it's working. And I think that that's kind of the way I like to describe it when people ask me, is to say, you know, you're going to get that maybe 24 hour of maybe a little bit of achiness, maybe a fever, something like that, but that's showing you that your immune system is having the desired response. And if we can couch it in those terms, people will understand that it's a good sign. It's a positive thing. Would you agree, Joe?
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. I completely forgot to mention that, and you are 100% correct. It is certainly not uncommon to have about 24 hours of maybe a little low-grade fever, some achiness, a little fatigue, some arm soreness maybe, and that sort of stuff. And you're exactly right. It's simply evidence that the virus has turned on your immune system, and your immune system has been working pretty hard for 24 hours as it cranks up to respond to that. And that is a good sign, actually. It's exactly what you want to see. It says that you are likely to get a good response from the vaccine. It also appears that after the first dose of vaccine, you probably have about 60% efficacy, a 60% response at about 10 days after the first dose of the vaccine. So the second dose for the Pfizer at 21 days or the Moderna at 28 days takes you to the 95% level that the studies talk about. So extremely important to, you know, not skip the second dose, because that's really what gets you up where you need to be. And to, as you mentioned, appreciate the fact that the day after the vaccination, you may feel, you know, a little slow and achy and feverish for 24 hours or so, but that's fine. But I do think that that's a legitimate enough concern that healthcare workers, EMS folks, and all that kind of stuff need to pay attention to how they schedule their staff so that they do not put the entire A shift out the next day feeling sick because they're all a little achy and don't feel good. So you should consider staggering it so that, you know, if 25% of your people are not feeling great that day, they can, you know, they don't wipe out your entire workforce for that shift.
Yeah, that would be a bad thing. Did you have another question, Jamie?
No, just wanted to just say, you know, it's important to remember that that second dose is vitally important to get, that you really want that 95% efficacy. And it's not unusual for vaccines to have multiple doses. And many of the childhood vaccines that kids get growing up are multiple dose vaccines. So just something to keep in mind that we need to encourage. You know, people listening to this show are mostly responders and providers and medical professionals of one sort or another, but it's incumbent upon us to educate the public we know, the neighbors and people we encounter, patients we encounter and others, that these are normal things, that the side effects from the injection are normal, and to that they, you know, to give them all the information so that they can make informed decisions about their need for the vaccine.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just getting that word out there and having people taking it seriously. Unlike the mask debate that still goes on, and I have a couple questions for you, Joe, and I know this is completely ridiculous, but I'd love to know where this information comes from. I was reading an article in the Washington Post about a small town in, I think, South Carolina that was having a huge COVID issue because originally one of their elected officials decided that masks weren't important. So now it's, you know, coming back to bite them in the proverbial but what was interesting to me was one of their responses, and there's three quick points here. First of all, this person says, nobody in this town died from the COVID virus because the COVID is no more than a mild cold. In fact, to the CDC, your chances of surviving the coronavirus is 99.07%. And according to Dr. Fauci, your chances of dying from the coronavirus is 0.1%. These people don't die from the coronavirus. They died from something else. Okay, where would those statistics come from and how real are they?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's statistics and there's damn statistics, you know. I think that the devil is in the details there. I'm not even sure where to start on some of this, you know. I think that the overall mortality from coronavirus so far, just offhand, and I really need to go look this up, is, you know, 4% of the people that are infected die. Yet I think part of the challenge here is that we have a hard time sometimes figuring that out. So, for example, you can get coronavirus and get the classic sort of, you know, respiratory illness that people are aware of, that's kind of the most common presentation of the illness, and you can die from that. But, you know, you can also get that in a mild form and die from a PE. And the real question is, well, would you have had a PE if you didn't get COVID-19? And, you know, sometimes yeah, and sometimes no. So it's hard to know how much of a difference that really made. There's certainly a lot of conspiracy theory out there about over-exaggerating the over 200,000 deaths so far and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I'll be the first to say that I'm sure there's a margin of error in all of that, but there's a margin of error in the number of people that died from the flu and die from tetanus every year and all kinds of other stuff. You know, it's not that cut and dried. In many cases, it's people that are diabetic and hypertensive and have heart disease, and then they get COVID, and then they clot off their coronary artery and they die of cardiac arrest. Well, was that heart disease or COVID? And the answer is, yeah, it was. It was both those things. So, you know, it's just that they all play off of each other. And the COVID obviously affects many different organ systems and clotting systems and the nervous system and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it plays some role. And I think it's very hard to ascertain exactly how much role it plays in an individual patient. So all you can do is sort of look at those numbers from a very high level, sort of at the population level, and try to ascertain compared to last year, you know, 1 million people died of heart disease. And this year it's been 2 million. And, you know, what's different between last year and this year? COVID. So, you know, you have to assume that that's the primary reason for the effect. You know, we didn't suddenly change our diet in the last 12 months, you know, enough to affect that level of population, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, a lot of those things just don't change that much. You have to sort of compare back to previous trends and curves and all that sort of stuff and go, did the increasing amount of heart disease curve over the last 10 years suddenly change in, you know, beginning in February of 2021? And the answer is, yeah, a lot. So there's not an awful lot of other stuff to blame that on except COVID. So it's got to be playing some role in that. Hard to say exactly how much, though.
That makes sense. Jamie, you had a comment.
Yeah, and Joe touched on this, I think, in great detail, but I just, you know, I think I've been telling people, you know, it's hard to make those numbers real until we have some perspective. And so 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the retrospective statistical studies of death rates compared to previous years and subsequent years will, I think, go a long way to firming up those numbers. So that we can have a real understanding of how many people actually died. It is my belief, and Joe, you said the same thing, is almost certainly it's higher than we're reporting. That because there's unexplained deaths that we attribute to other things, but the numbers are higher than expected. And what's the difference? It's COVID. So I think we won't know for 5 or 10 years until we can look back and do that type of in-depth statistical analysis. But in the meantime, we have a deadly virus on hand. And if it's killing extra people for any reason, there's reason enough for us to take precautions and do the right thing to protect ourselves and our neighbors.
Completely agree with that. I mean, I think all you got to do is take a look at the status of hospitals across the country right now. Look at Southern California. There's not an ICU bed in Southern California available now. So, you know, you can say that's COVID or not COVID, but, you know, there's no ICU beds available. So something's going on.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of ICU and so forth, this person also said that it's a financial incentive for the hospital and the doctors that every time COVID is listed on a death certificate, the doctor in the hospital get $13,000. Or if a patient dies on a respirator, they get $40,000.
Yeah, my response to that is bullshit.
Thank you.
That's just crap.
That's exactly what I, you know, where do these people get that information? And let me just throw out the last thing. I know we're running a little long here. This is the one that really gets me. Wearing a mask is harmful. You breathe in your own toxins, which can cause lung cancer, gum disease, and other problems. So I don't know where this person gets their medical license, but I'd love to hear your take on that.
I'll respond to that with bullshit as well.
So none of the above is true, right?
No, it's all absurd, ridiculous misinformation from people that have their own agenda about something. None of that's accurate.
Well, what's unfortunate is it's driving this mask-hating agenda on some people, and these are the ones running around that may be infecting other people. You know, that's the sad part of this. So I wanted to discuss this so people out there, not that our people would know the difference, I mean, they know better, is to say, wait a minute, just because someone throws a bunch of facts out there doesn't mean there's any accuracy there whatsoever. And not wearing a mask is a bad thing for you and for everybody you come in contact with. And I'll get off the soapbox. Jamie?
Yeah, and I agree with you, Sam. I think that this is, for whatever reason, has become needlessly, I don't know, bipolar, for lack of a better term.
That's a good term.
You know, it's just crazy. And I don't know why people have decided this is something to live or die and set your flag and say, this is where we're going to die because I'm not going to wear a mask. Well, you know, I think that's, you know, problematic for not just them, but for their whole community. Joe, you know, thanks so much for sharing. I've been thinking about you and everybody else out there that I know that's working in the facilities right now and dealing with this surge. Are you and the people you know, holding the line and doing well to keep yourselves on the straight and narrow and as far as your own stress and sanity?
Yeah, you know, thanks, Jamie. I think the answer is yes. You know, it is relentless in its demands on people's time. I literally am doing something related to COVID from 6 o'clock in the morning till midnight every night, and then 2 or 3 calls at night sometimes. It certainly wears on you. I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. I think the vaccine will definitely help, but we're going to have a very dark winter before a much brighter spring. It's going to take a while for the vaccine to really have much of an impact on that, but at least, from a very personal level, the idea that I can get vaccinated in the next couple of weeks, I hope, and, you know, by the end of January can begin to relax a little bit about my daily concerns that I'm bringing the virus home to my wife and kids and neighbors and others, just to sort of alleviate that concern will be absolutely wonderful, that I would no longer be a potential vector for the disease. And I can sort of go about doing what I can do to make a difference without having to worry about that aspect of it. It just takes one little thing off the plate, I think, and that's going to be a huge thing to get off the plate.
Absolutely.
So I'm hearing be patient and do your part.
We got to continue to take care of ourselves with what we know works, masking and distancing and hand washing and the usual. And we got to get vaccinated. Please, please go get a vaccine as quickly as you can. This thing is very safe, and I cannot wait to get access to it. So please go get vaccinated.
Absolutely.
You don't have to ask me twice.
Yeah, me either. So Joe, just real quick, you know, Paragon Medical Education Group is a great resource for education, and we've talked a lot about the importance of good education just in this episode alone, and some of the things that people believe or don't believe. So where can folks find out more about what Paragon Medical Education Group is up to and how you guys can help folks get the training they need for disaster preparedness and more?
Well, we are always happy to share our teaching concepts and put together programs specifically to help anybody. We love to talk to folks about how we can do that. So find us on the web at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, or you can always reach us at the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
And Sam, how about you?
Well, on social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and in our ever-growing Facebook group on under Disaster Podcast, of course, and disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
And folks can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And, of course, at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, continuing to grow, and we're excited about that. So join the group over there and follow our regular posts for episodes as they become available. Good episode, Sam. I'm glad you were able to get this out there. I think it's important for Joe to share what he's seeing so that people can get the real word about what's going on.
And Joe, that was just some amazing information. I'm really going to push this one out, not just to our own community, but to everybody out there, because what you had to say is just right on. And with that, I'll just basically say two words: get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated.